place of origin, and the reason why they're seeking asylum somewhere else is because they're being persecuted, and often that can be on the basis, it's not exclusively on the basis of, you know, protected grounds like their gender or their sexual orientation, their race or ethno-cultural identity, but it can be. And this is what Section 15 is specifically aimed at providing protection for.
The Supreme Court heard that case last fall and is expected to deliver its ruling soon. But there's another thing. A part of the STCA is that Canada would conduct reviews of the U.S. as a safe country, looking at whether it was compliant with things like the Refugee Convention and Convention Against Torture. But the problem, says Maureen, is that these reviews are completely opaque.
Canada is supposed to be looking at the United States human rights record. And importantly, Canada is meant to conduct ongoing reviews of this kind of compliance. So that's been a bit of an issue because the reviews are not transparent. They're not proactively disclosed. And no one really has a good sense of not only what the human rights records are that Canada is looking at, but also what the conclusions are and what the measure is. So part of the problem, these reviews are done in secret.
She said it's also important to note that Canada has accepted claims from irregular border crossers at a rate that is comparable to regular claims, meaning that the type of crossing has almost no bearing on whether a person qualifies as a refugee or not. In the U.S., President Joe Biden recently announced new measures that would make it even harder for migrants to claim asylum at the southern border.
That notice of proposed rulemaking, as well as what we announced on January 5th, reflects a overarching strategy of building lawful pathways and then, as a complement to that, deliver consequences to those who do not avail themselves of the lawful pathways.
This was announced just as Title 42 comes to an end, another immigration measure that was enacted during the pandemic and allowed the U.S. to turn back migrants on the basis of public health, which actually stranded thousands in Mexico. A cost-benefit analysis of the new STCA expansion was published recently by the Government of Canada. It reads that the secretive new routes that migrants will take as a result of the new law would, quote, increase the risks of human trafficking and sexual violence targeted at women, girls, and LGBTQI individuals. The memo said that migrants are likely to turn to illicit networks for support. And as a side note, these new rules will also cost an estimated $60 million over 10 years.
So it's actually quite shocking that in light of all of this evidence, everything that the Canadian government is aware of in terms of the deficiencies in the U.S. asylum system, that instead of pulling back these harsh measures, the pendulum actually has swung the other way and the border is now virtually closed aside from some pre-existing exemptions.
Maureen says we could be looking into ways to mitigate the harms by creating exemptions in the agreement. In particular, the groups of people least served by the U.S. asylum system, who Canada could be a safe refuge for, like creating exemptions for people facing gender-based violence.
So I hope that understanding that there are public policy tools to mitigate some of the harsh consequences of the expansion, that the government will sit down and have a serious look at what could be done as a path forward.
Many advocates have called for the end of the Safe Third Country Agreement. They want to strike it down completely. But to do so would be to say that, yes, the U.S. is unsafe for migrants. And while it may be true, doing so would be a huge political statement. In the face of the longstanding, economically important, and friendly relationship Canada has with the U.S., that could be a disastrous statement to make. It might not be something most Canadian leaders or politicians would be willing to stand behind, but there are some calling for Canada to take that bold step. Chris Alexander was the former Minister of Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship, serving under Stephen Harper. He was also Canada's ambassador to Afghanistan in the early 2000s. In a panel in 2020, hosted by the Global Migration Lab at the University of Toronto, he was clear. Canada needs to face the truth about the U.S.
So I don't think there's any way a serious expert with experience in these fields could argue that the United States is a safe place for refugees today. Better than a lot of other countries still, yes. Able to adjudicate many cases, yes. But safe by the standards of the Refugee Convention and the other international instruments whose principles we're supposed to be living up to in these difficult times, no. It should be about peer review, stating the truth, helping each other get to a better place. There have been times in Canada's history where we didn't do as well on these issues. Today, we should take pride in the fact that we are in a better place and not indulge in the fiction that the United States is anywhere close to meeting the standards that we expect.
But for now, while Canada continues to uphold this agreement, there are real people who will have to decide if they want to experience just how safe the U.S. asylum system really is, or risk a now illegal border crossing into Canada.
People want to be safe and have a better life, and then they will try. It's like when I try to cross the desert 10 days, 10 nights, and I don't want to go back. I want to get to a place where I can be free and have a better living without fear. Many people, they will continue going to a different places to be safe and be free. If they want to block the borders, close the border, they have to open a solution for the people too, because every time they make it harder, people are going to go around, and sometimes they die trying to get to a safe country.
That's your Canada Land. We try to bring you stories like this, stories that we don't think you're going to hear elsewhere. You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Website is canadaland.com. Today's episode was reported by Cherise Suturin. It was produced by Tristan Capicione, our audio editor and technical producer, with production assistance from Jonathan Goldsby, our news editor. The managing editor of Canada Land is Annette Ejofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Nora Loretto, writer, activist, co-host of Sandy and Nora Talk Politics. Hello.
Hello.
Today on the show, Nora, how dare you call us government-funded? We're government-funded! The CBC lets Elon Musk know who's boss. Welcome back to Shortcuts, Nora, where we talk shit about the news.
Fun to be here.
CBC/Radio Canada said it is pausing its use of Twitter a day after its main account was labeled government-funded media by the social media platform.
This is being used by conservative leader Pierre Poilievre to really rally up his base.
I think it says a lot about the Conservative Party of Canada.
Nora, how dare they? How dare they accuse the CBC of being government-funded? Okay, here's the backstory. I think this chapter began when Elon Musk, Twitter's shambolic owner, in the most recent chapter of his, like, I think why he did it, to kind of like put his thumb in the eye of journalists. The thing with rich guys, I'm digressing already. We're just starting the story. But like, and I've known people like this, like, it really galls the wealthy that some schmuck journalist can talk shit about them, you know, like because in their universe of power, like, we shouldn't exist. Like, we should not be able to say these things. So I think that it's like the idea that he can't control the way he is defined, and that people who are in a certain way smarter and wittier and just like more responsible about facts are constantly smearing his reputation with those facts is like, this is why rich people have been buying newspapers since, I don't know, Charles Foster Kane, who is fictional, but you get my point. That's what this is all about, is we'll see about that, you assholes. I'm buying Twitter. How about that? And that sort of explains everything that's happened since with Elon Musk and Twitter. And I think that this most recent chapter began when he changed the designation of NPR, not to government-funded media, but to state-affiliated media, which is the same designation Twitter gives to, like, you know, Xinhua in China or, like, Russian state media. Like, basically, he was saying, NPR, you're no better than these state propaganda outlets. And an uproar followed, and NPR said, well, we're leaving Twitter, which I think was justified in that case because they're not state media in that sense. And then there was some kind of reconciliation with Twitter's own definitions where government-funded media became the moniker for NPR. And then, okay, it's going to roll out across the world. And it's inevitable that it's going to happen in Canada. It's going to be applied to the CBC. And Pierre Poilievre, that clever little Vadel, I have to be a little bit impressed. Like, it's going to happen anyhow. And he goes, I hereby ask that Elon Musk label CBC government-funded media because they're nothing but a bunch of state propagandists, like knowing that that was going to happen anyhow. And then it's like, see, I do control the richest man in the world. He did what I asked him to do.
Yeah, this whole affair has been very annoying because all of the characters in the affair are annoying, to say the least. And I think, you know, referencing the fact that rich people have always wanted to purchase media and control media narratives in different ways is a really important way to start with this, because Elon Musk purchasing Twitter de facto made him one of the world's most powerful publishers, even though he controls the way that people interact on his platform in a much different way than any of the other rich people that own newspapers might control them. So like the Irvings or the Thompsons, any of the families in Canada, or I mean, you know, the Republican hedge fund that owns Post Media, there's a lot more direct control over how they're able to control what is written. And with Twitter, it's this free-for-all, and so the only way that he can control things is doing things like saying CBC is 69% publicly funded, right? Which was one of his, like, slapping that label onto the CBC's Twitter account.
We need to explain that, because there's no better evidence that he is just trolling. And that's when the CBC argued, well, we're not fully government-funded, we're less than 70% government-funded. And then he goes, okay, you win. And then he puts on 69%. So if anyone out there thinks, like, because people are being like, well, they are, you know, like, this is just simply, this is what they are. They're government funded. It's like, well, that is true. They are government funded. It's also true that this guy is just a shitlord who is in bad faith, having a laugh. And maybe that's a funny joke. I don't know. But, like, he does not give a not about CBC, not about Canada, not about the public discourse. This is, like, he's trolling the country and trolling the CBC.
Well, he's swinging his dick around and he doesn't really care, like, what it hits. You know, like, to see Canadian journalists be like, wow, the response from Twitter was a poop emoji to our requests for comment, as if that hasn't literally been the request for comment for every single media request to Twitter for the last little while. There's this hilarious kind of Canadian exceptionalism in this story that we're too embedded in English Canada to really properly, like, appreciate. And so treating the CBC like NPR, I think that's an interesting place to start, because NPR and the CBC are very, very different beasts. CBC is mainstream. It's the backbone of media in Canada. It's the only media in a lot of parts of this country where it's particularly difficult to broadcast or it's not profitable to broadcast. And he declares war on them. And so that's kind of one story. The second story, which I think is far more important, is how Poilievre intervenes in all of this. The decades-long attack that the Conservatives have waged against the CBC, this is where it gets a lot more complicated, because the CBC management is aware that the second the Conservatives get elected, their goose may be cooked. And yet they still have to produce journalism that is unbiased or that doesn't favor one party or the other, recognizing that there is literally a party out there that wants to destroy them. And the reason why the Conservatives have been so successful in demonizing the CBC is because people can feel that the quality of the news, the quality of coverage, the way that coverage happens, the number of journalists, the location of where those journalists broadcast from, like the quality has gotten far worse. And rather than looking at kind of the world today and saying, what role does public broadcasting play in a world that's dominated by social media, giant corporations that are all privately owned and operated by freaky millionaires, billionaires, they have just kind of turtled, they've cowered, and rather than innovating, it's just like, you know, let's just try to keep our heads down, let's just keep doing the good journalism that we're doing, and let's rest on those laurels. And that's just, you know, I think that that's put the CBC in a very vulnerable spot for attack. And I think that the second Polly ever gets elected, which will happen at some point, the English service is toast. I think that the French service, that's a whole other thing. But I think that, you know, it's going to be reduced to radio and barely.
So their response to being labeled government funded has been to take their ball and go home. The CBC has said that it is pausing its use of Twitter a day after Twitter labeled them government funded media. And here's the quote. Twitter can be a powerful tool for a journalist to communicate with Canadians, but it undermines the accuracy and professionalism of the work they do to allow our independence to be falsely described in this way. How dare Twitter falsely describe them as government-funded media on Twitter? Nora, do you know who described the CBC as government-funded on Twitter?
The CBC itself? Like...
The CBC. In 2017, they said, yeah, we're government-funded. We also have ad money. So their argument is, well, we're actually publicly funded, which is like, if that is what you're standing on at this point, the semantic difference between being government funded and publicly funded as the reason for exiting the platform. Like, first of all, never have a fight with a troll on their own terms where they control the semantics. They should be saying, yeah, we are government funded. We are proud public broadcasters. That's what it means to be a public broadcaster. To agree that that is an insinuation, a suggestion, or a slight is the weakest position, as if there's something wrong with being government-funded media. And I mean, it opens up all kinds of other things, of course, because now we have to like ask the question, should not every single recipient of the government media bailout also now be given the government-funded media sticker by Twitter? But I want to stick with why this was a terrible decision for the CBC. And I agree with you that they're vulnerable because they have been slipping in very serious ways journalistically and just in terms of like, it's really hard to think of a CBC journalist with any gravitas that's left. There's lots of great reporters there, but Lyndon McIntyre and Carol Off and Enright and like all of these people, Anna Maria Tremonti, like all of these people who used to be like to varying degrees, like you took them seriously and they spoke to people like you were an intelligent citizen of Canada, are gone. And what's left are a lot of talented people, but I don't know that anyone is really inhabiting that space anymore. I've gotten a lot of responses by people like, it's like everyone is happy with this, weirdly. All of the conservatives on Twitter are like, yeah, f*** off. Goodbye, CBC. Good riddance. Great. Twitter's like really going to benefit from not having the biggest news organization in Canada. Like, no, you're just leaving that space for the worst shit and great stuff like Canada Land. And then the CBC supporters are saying, good riddance to us. We're not going to stick around for this kind of abuse. We're leaving here. I'm curious your point of view on this. I have my thoughts on why this is a very bad move. I actually think it's a dangerous move and an arrogant one. I feel, first of all, like the CBC has a duty. It has a mandate. It has a mission. It is tasked to deliver Canadians the news that we pay for where we choose to get our news. That's why whenever we go from radio to TV, they go to TV. When the internet becomes a thing, they move on to the internet. They are supposed to go where the audience is. That's their mandate. That's why they went on the internet. And last time I checked, something like 6 million Canadians have a Twitter account. It is the first place I get my news from, and millions of others, like whatever is going on there with ownership, it is still a major news channel. So I don't get to determine as a publisher of Canada Land. I don't like what's happening with Twitter, but this is where people get their news. It's free. It's trivial for us to make our news available there and to engage there. So we do it. And for the CBC to not do that, I think is just out of step with what they're supposed to be doing. But then, and this is important and hasn't been discussed as far as I can tell, Twitter is where every government has an official presence. Every public figure has an official presence. Every company has an official presence. Every MP has an official presence. As reporters, we don't get to determine where the people we cover make their statements and where we can scrum them. When they choose a public space to go say stuff, and we get the privilege of asking them questions in public, which is a very powerful thing to do as a reporter. It's very different than asking questions in private where they could just be ignored or they can be war-roomed and, you know, spun. I mean, that could still happen, but when you can actually confront somebody in public because they wanted to speak in public, well, if you want to speak in public, you're going to be questioned in public. Twitter serves that purpose. To abandon that space is to abandon your responsibility as a reporter who covers things in public. I don't understand how you could do that. There's no alternative to that. There's no other social media space where all of those public figures, every MP and party and company is there communicating every day.
Well, and not just there communicating every day, but like on a single feed or on a single stream where you can actually see everything together. You know, Facebook is too siloed for that and LinkedIn is too freaky and weird and employer dominated. And something might emerge in the next couple of years to replace what Twitter is. But I totally agree with you that, you know, this seems like the laziest decision, right? The laziest, the safest, the decision that Navigator told them to do. Like, in theory, I'm not saying that they're talking to Navigator, but that would be the laziest, easiest, most risk-cautious decision is just pull off your main accounts that you're not going to interact anymore, but do not pull off your journalists. Your journalists can still interact on Twitter. The articles are still going to be shared on Twitter because that's how people share news. And I suspect that the majority of Twitter traffic to CBC web pages is coming through individuals sharing articles or journalists sharing their own articles and not CBC News sharing a particular article. So for all these reasons, it's a PR stunt and it's lazy. And it's exactly what Musk wants. Like, this is exactly what he wants.
Yeah,
and so,
yeah.
Like, not only should you not tango with a troll on their terms, but what does this achieve? Like, if the criticism is that you will not be on a platform owned by someone that doesn't respect your news, how can you even interview the Conservative Party of Canada then? You know, like, it doesn't actually, there's not a logic here that can be evenly applied. And so without an evenly applied logic, we descend into hypocrisy. What do people hate the most? They hate hypocrisy. And the CDC, like, I don't know if you saw this, on Sunday night when they first announced that they got the government funding tag, their article first quoted Pierre Poilievre, right? And we talked about this on Sandy and Nora, and Sandy was like, do you think NPR ran to the Republicans to say, hey, what do you think about us being called state-sponsored media? No, of course not. You know, like, Poilievre was part of the story. Okay, if you had to include him, he could be below all of the other people that you would quote in the article. But the CBC is so bad at understanding these forces.
And you described it well as turtling, because I think that this made sense to them. But I think that they made the calculation of like, well, great. Twitter has been a place where, you know, every other day we're trending from people who hate us.
Mm-hmm.
Our reporters are getting abused there. It's just a huge headache. Fuck it. Because, like, they don't get paid more if their news has impact or is part of the conversation or if they're fulfilling their mandate. Like, great. Let's turtle. Let's go to the platforms that we control. And the loser here is the Canadian public. On the one hand, they're just ludicrous. The idea that this is state-sponsored media, they're just, like, doing what Trudeau wants them to do. Like, the things they say, it's almost like, I don't think you've ever actually watched or listened to the CBC. You know, like, having worked there, it's just not like that, you know? On the other hand, you also can look at everything that's happened since Trudeau has been in power and ask yourself the question, well, where has the rigorous accountability journalism come from? The stories that Trudeau really didn't want to see published. And the CBC was not leading the pack with any of them.
Except Radio-Canada.
Ah, a noteworthy exception that I'm not really in a position I wouldn't know to say so. But yeah, there is something to it. It's not about Trudeau controlling the CBC. It's about a political class. It's about establishment thinking. It's about a soft approach. And it is about the culture of Canada and a certain alignment with circles of influence and power that overlap. And then you look at these little things like the Rosie Barton selfie with Trudeau or her being on the lawsuit against the Conservatives. I'm not saying I agree, but I get it. I get it. If it wasn't the CBC, if the National Post was getting $1.5 billion a year from the government to publish things that were completely contrary to my political bent, I would be pretty cheesed about that. The CBC is not ready for this fight, and I'll fight for them, even if they're not willing to fight for themselves. We need them, right? Like, we do not have local reporters in many parts of this country. We need a strong public broadcaster, and I don't know that they understand what they're actually involved in or who they're up against here. To allow themselves to be politicized in this way, they've played into the hands of, right now it looks very clear to anyone who's looking at this, oh, Trudeau is on one side with the CBC. He funds them. He says nice things about journalists. He protects them. He protects other journalists. Poilievre is on the other side against the CBC and with Twitter. And the CBC's position should be very firmly, that we're not on anybody's side here. We're public broadcasters. We tell the story. And instead, they are playing into this, like, yes, Elon Musk, Pierre Poilievre. And then Trudeau says, this tells us everything we need to know about the conservatives. And it really does appear like the media has been politicized in a way that I don't know how they get out of that. I don't know how they fight on here, but we need them to.
I do. I mean, the problem is that the Conservative Party has been very, very good at getting into the parts of Canada that are feeling ignored, underrepresented, and marginalized for some reason or in some way. And part of the reason that they're so good at that is because they have a really good ground game, that riding by riding in every single part of Canada, they are present, you know, even places where they've got no chance, they are present. And they understand that this is a very diverse country from region to region. It's a very diverse country in terms of the economic mix. And so the economic interests of different regions, like they need to be able to speak to all of those things. And, you know, I was doing a presentation on fake news in Regina, and both times when I start the presentation off, I said, well, what is fake news? In the two presentations, someone yelled out the CBC and Justin Trudeau controls it, which I just thought was so fascinating because it's like, okay, so why do you think that? And what's so clear is that people feel completely unrepresented by the public broadcaster. And I actually don't think that that has to do with politics. I think that that has to do with centralization, decisions made out of Toronto, guests that are constantly booked who have no idea how to even pronounce Saskatchewan, for example. Like, people hear that. And, you know, as someone living in an outpost as well, certainly, like, I mean, an Anglophone outpost, like, the amount of our news that comes from Toronto, like, you cannot find out what's going on in this province unless you listen to French Radio-Canada. And I know that that's very, very similar in a lot of different parts of this country. So if the CBC wants to save itself, they have to understand that as the public broadcaster, they need to be representing the people in those regions all across this country that feel like they have nothing. And when so much of our media is owned by post media, I mean, the time is now for the CBC to do this and to do these little games and to, oh, we're going to leave Twitter. It's like, that's not useful. That's not how anyone wants to see adults interact with one another. Decentralize and pour your resources into local news. It's that simple.
Nora, that's Shortcuts. Thank you so much for joining me this week. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read what you send, all of it. Where can people find you? Where can they find your podcast?
Yeah, well, I haven't left Twitter yet, so you can still find me there as well. And I have a new daily news podcast that people should definitely check out. Every episode comes out 9 o'clock in the morning and they don't run more than 10 minutes. You get four or five headlines of what's going on. So you can check that out at sandynora.com/daily-news or find me on Twitter. I share it all the time.
This episode is produced by Ren Bangert with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.